Nestled into a storefront on Turk Street in San Francisco's Fillmore District is the St. John I. M. Coltrane African Orthodox Church. And there it is. And I have an order of service from it that a friend brought back with him from a pilgrimage. It was a pilgrimage. The church wasn't founded by John Coltrane, the quintessential archetypal transcendental bebop jazz tenor saxophonist, but his life and music and philosophy inspired a man named Franzo Wayne King to gather and inspire a small church for many years now. Four of the church's six ministers play saxophone, and the other three cover bass, piano, and vocals as needed. Can you imagine a church where everyone showed up to board meetings with their instruments? Might not get any business done, but a church I once served had quarterly jazz Sundays led by a University of Texas scholar of jazz who specialized in the work of John Coltrane. I swear this guy could channel John Coltrane. He had studied every breath, every nuance of his playing. It was like being fed by a bebop fire hose every few months. Now, that was a lot of music for my mostly church organ-loving congregation. And I was often asked, at first, what's so spiritual about this jazz stuff? And bebop is no easy listen. Bebop as a jazz form comes after the big swing band music of like Glenn Miller and Count Basie. And it comes before freeform fusion and contemporary jazz. Bebop is characterized by fast, improvised lines, almost intellectual musical ideas bouncing between musicians and building, and complex musical progressions, chordal progressions. It's a challenging read. So the question, maybe it was a challenging read or challenging listen for some of us here this morning. This may be the first time you've heard this kind of jazz music. I've always felt that any kind of music, in answer to the question, what's so spiritual about jazz, I felt like any kind of music played from the heart is spiritual because it moves the spirit. But jazz, more than any other music I know, speaks from the heart of the American experience as well, which is one both of oppression and transcendence. There is both struggle and hope in what we call the American experience, the blues of suffering, the soaring hopes of freedom, and the cultural tensions that bump and struggle toward wholeness. What we call America was stolen from First Nations people, then infused with Enlightenment values that spoke of liberty and promise. What we call America was built upon the backs of slaves stolen from homes and villages, then infused with emancipation and broken promises of equality, promises that we even need to live into today. What we call America was fashioned by a white supremacist culture, yet in our very Constitution lies the methods for dismantling that privilege, the right to speak freely and confront power, the right to vote out the deranged dictators, the right to confront bullies and the brutality. What we call America is transcendent, existing with both its flaws and its potential simultaneously. Transcendent, existing in the tensions of oppression and liberty. Now, the meaning of transcendent is also worth some definition. We UUs love our transcendentalists, and I often hear from us, and what does that mean again? Most of us relate closely in our theology to the New England transcendentalists who took to the woods and said, God is more out there than in your dusty churches. The transcendentalists who gathered in parlors as much to explore ideas and books as to explore each other's hearts with intimacy and trust. The transcendentalists who shaped American letters, and more importantly for us, an understanding of the holy that courses through each and every human heart. We love our transcendentalist saints like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, and Margaret Fuller. But what does transcendental mean? You can look up the word in the dictionary and get a few meanings. But what transcendental means to me is that thing which has the potential to rise above what it is, beyond what it might be imagined. To be transcendental is to have the potential to be more thing, more things than one thing in the moment, to be both broken and whole, to be both the downtrodden and the hopeful, to be both of the earth and the stars, to be both dust and stardust in the same instance, to be nature and God. Even the idea of God viewed with a transcendental lens requires God to be several things, both fully contained in each of us and everywhere at the same time. Transcendentalism requires you to embrace the paradox of an experience that says it's all provable through science, and we believe in science, don't we? And that there's a mystery that we'll never understand, both at the same time. This drives our humanists nuts, right? This paradox in which we live theologically. And no musical form embodies the transcendental better than jazz. If you don't understand anything that I'm saying, listen to it. You might get it there. For jazz to work, the soloist has to be absolutely free and yet playing within the structure of the music. For jazz to work, the soloist has to embrace their full individuality as a musician and yet be in total relationship, total sync, utter dependence with the other players. As Sharon Welch suggests, can you imagine a world where everyone played like this? A world where I admit my completeness as an individual and at the same time my utter dependence on every single one of you. Where my freedom is limited only by my love for every single one of you. What makes jazz spiritual? It can take us there. It can teach us there. It transcends boundaries. It isn't rooted as an art form in one social expression, but keeps pulling in more ideas, more cultural references, more tension, more release. Even the history of jazz speaks to this cultural transcendence. Of the birth of jazz in New Orleans more than 100 years ago, and its ancestry in the musical traditions of both Africa and Europe. From African musical traditions, jazz receives its core rhythms in a tradition of making your instrument synonymous with your voice. Your instrument is your voice. And from the European music tradition, jazz receives a classical notion of harmony based on chords and 12-note scales. And the instruments themselves. According to the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz, New Orleans was the perfect city for all these elements to come together. It was a port city where different ethnic groups could mingle, especially in a nightlife where musicians had the opportunity to play together, learn from each other, and blend all of these elements. Jazz was also born out of and evolved through the African-American experience in the United States. From spirituals and then blues, singing songs of oppression and freedom. This morning's message about jazz and transcendence was scheduled for May when our monthly theme was embodiment. But our white supremacy teach-in rightfully and righteously preempted the schedule. So while this morning's message is a little off from our monthly themes, I'm grateful we were able to explore this idea of transcendence and embodiment through musical expression together. I'm also grateful for the flexibility of our musical guests, Brian Gephardt on saxophone, Michael Arnopol on bass, and our own Carl Monsk on piano, because they were able to move their dates around at the last minute and let us do that important work together. Music, healing, embodiment, transcendence. I hope we are getting to a place of understanding of how they might fit together. Or if not understanding, perhaps you'll feel it. It's been a challenging year emotionally for this church. So maybe a dose of music might just be what the doctor ordered. The ups and downs of church life have taken a toll on our hearts. From wondering if Eileen, who this congregation will ordain this evening, would stay with us for a couple more years, to saying goodbye to Reverend Connie next week after her many faithful years of service to this congregation. It has been a heavy and joyful and sorrowful time. And so many deaths in the congregation this year, with more not far away as several members enter hospice to begin their end-of-life journeys with their families. A musician friend of mine once said that music gives us a way to move through and order our unstructured feelings. If this is true, I've needed a good dose of music this month. A way to go through the unstructured feelings of joy and sorrow, of happiness and of grief. Since God moves in mysterious ways, a rummage sale find last month did the trick for me when I came across a pristine collection of a 20-box set, 120 vinyl records of the Time Life story of music and the great concerts. The collection had sat there unsold in our rummage seraglio. Look it up. And before it was disposed of, for donation to the church, of course, I decided to lug it all home. I later discovered the records had been collected by Courtney Lawson, a longtime member who died this year, earlier this year. A few of the records have notations written on them, on the actual discs themselves, on the paper inserts, and in the little accompanying books. He would make notes, okay, check. I mean, talk about like an embodied ministry, listening to a member who was passed, listening to his love of music, disc by disc. And I've made a commitment to myself to listen to a side each day as part of my morning devotionals, a tone poem or a symphonic movement, maybe a cello concerto, my favorite instrument. Whatever is next in the box, I pull it out and let the grace flood over me. Except for the Italian opera box, I cannot start my day with Puccini. I know, I'll get there. But it's been good medicine for me, revisiting the music that has healed my soul since I discovered my first scratchy copy of Scheherazade at the library in junior high school. And I suggest maybe that's some good medicine for you too, if you're struggling through this time. A good dose of Beethoven or Coltrane might do the trick. And that was my life through high school. Punk rock and symphonies. Pretty much nothing in between. Everything you ever need to know about me may be in that dualism. But after high school, while I was playing trombone in an Air Force swing band, jazz came into my life. At least a jazz beyond the trite Hal Leonard easy arrangements that I had played in high school and college, and it never really captured my heart. I remember first hearing John Coltrane's A Love Supreme for the first time. It was on vinyl, of course. CDs had just come out, but we were skeptical of this new technology. I knew that it just didn't sound right. I was sitting with friends drinking coffee before bed, something you can do at 20 years old. And we listened on some floor-standing speakers that we had found abandoned in an alley, but the cones were still good. It was magical. Whenever I need deep soul repair, A Love Supreme is still my go-to piece. It's one of the few recordings I own, record, CD, even MP3. And without going into John Coltrane's whole biography, there are a few things you should know about his life in order to understand the significance of this piece, of A Love Supreme. Coltrane was born in 1926, and his mother bought him a saxophone at 17 years old so he could play in the school band. 2 years later, he was playing professionally in nightclubs. By all accounts, he was a virtuoso. To avoid the draft, Coltrane enlisted in the Army and at his first base, Pearl Harbor. I'm sorry, he enlisted in the Navy to avoid the Army. And at his first base, Pearl Harbor, he began playing with the all-white band on base called the Melody Makers. He effectively broke the color barrier. After the war, Coltrane, now just known as Train, played with Coleman Hawkins, Dizzy Gillespie, and John Hodges, to name a few, before attracting the attention of Miles Davis, who he played with on and off through the mid-50s. By that time, Coltrane had, for almost a decade, developed a significant heroin addiction. That and a righteous musical rivalry strained his relationship with Miles Davis until they couldn't play together any longer. 1957 is the year that something happened. He didn't talk much or write about what it was that transformed his life. We know that Coltrane kicked his heroin habit. And we know he found God, but not the strictly Christian God that he had grown up with. He read Hindu texts and Buddhist texts. He found a universalist God that courses through all faiths. It was a cosmic God. It was an earthy God. A Love Supreme, written in 1964, was his thank you prayer to that God for saving his life. He didn't talk about his transformation beyond a few liner notes. He played the transformation for us. In those sparse liner notes of A Love Supreme, Coltrane says that in 1957, I experienced by the grace of God a spiritual awakening that was to lead me to a richer, fuller, more productive life. At that time, in gratitude, I humbly asked to be given the means and the privilege to make others happy through music. Coltrane's God was all-inclusive. He said it was vibrational and cosmic as well as traditionally religious. His God was in the name of Allah, in the teachings of Jesus, in the Dharma. The name of Coltrane's divine, the most accurate one for him, the name was found in the title of the piece itself, A Love Supreme. God, it's a love supreme. It's a name worthy of awe, omnipotent, all-conquering love, a love that changed his life, a love that isn't mamby-pamby, but has some power behind it, a love that healed him from heroin addiction, a love that brought the music back. Perhaps the most memorable moment of the piece happens between the opening fanfare and the moment and the first movement's conclusion, where Coltrane begins chanting over and over, chanting, a love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme. Says Buddhist Wayne Shorter, and a musician of this chant, when he started singing the words, a love supreme, he didn't solicit the vocal expertise of some well-known record-selling singer. I think he was saying, you must rely on yourself for the communication. I think he was going back to square one, where the voice is the first announcement of your humanity. Your humanity is the instrument. Of the original recording, Dan Morgenstern writes, there was a kind of telepathy between the musicians. You couldn't say who was the leader and who was the follower. What a lesson for us in our church work, our justice work, our relational work, to lead and follow seamlessly, taking turns, doing handoffs. Jazz offers us so many lessons like this for our work to change the world, transform lives, even our own, especially our own. It acknowledges the presence of suffering and the hope of transcendence out of the milieu of ego, competition, skill, submission, talent, and chaos. There will be order in the shifts between dissonance and harmony. There will be convergence. There will be unity out of the suffering. Jazz acknowledges accountability and responsibility. You can't do it alone, it says, and freedom only comes from understanding your responsibility to act out contributions in relationship to others. Freedom out of relationship. A musician doesn't go very far when they don't get that relationship, when they don't watch and listen. Jazz affirms that we have to listen to the conversation in order to participate. It takes more listening than leading as we go from theme to improvisation to resolution. Resolution out of listening. In participation. And so let us listen to the final movement and resolution of A Love Supreme and hear the sound of ideas blending, hear the sound of stories finding resolution, hear the sound of freedom and promise, hear the resolving moment of Coltrane's prayer, hear as form gives way to transcendence, or just listen as A Love Supreme moves your heart toward the attraction of love and healing and transformation.